You probably know the story of the little boy who opened the old family Bible that had been gathering dust on the shelf for many a year. And he looked with fascination at it as he carefully turned the old crinkly pages of the Bible. And then something fell out of it, and he picked it up and looked at it with great amazement. It was an old leaf that had been pressed between its pages seemingly ages ago. "Mama, look what I found," the boy called out with excitement. His mother asked, "What do you have, dear?" And with astonishment in the young boy's voice, he said, "I think it's Adam's suit." Ah, the imagination of a child. But most of you probably know that story. That's an old joke. What you might not know is the true story set back in the 1950s in the Deep South, where I teach, of a young girl who went shopping with her dad in a department store. And she had been looking forward to this excursion for quite a while because she had heard that at this store she could drink a special kind of water from a fountain. And over on the wall, she saw two water fountains, each with a sign under it. Excitedly, she turned the knob on the left fountain, expecting to see a spray of water filled with vibrant, colored streams to quench her thirst. But, much to her disappointment, it was just plain old water. Her dad had to tell her that the sign below the fountain referred not to the water, but to her skin. The innocence and imagination of a child crushed, and with it, justice overturned. Tonight, we continue our talk about the role of imagination in the Psalms. This morning, I tried to lay the groundwork for our investigation for tonight and for tomorrow in the use of metaphor in the Psalter. And I tried to make the case that such an investigation, to be conducted adequately, requires not only the exercise of faithful imagination, the imagination of the reader, but also an acute sensitivity to how the authors of Scripture, the psalmists, the sages, the prophets of Scripture, exercised their imaginations. Hence, some grasp of their world, the world of the remote past, is paramount, as well as the world of the text. And so, tonight, I hope we're going to have some fun. We're going to put it into practice. But before embarking in search of buried metaphors in selected psalms, it is first necessary to step back and scope out the lay of the land, that is, to ascertain something of the Psalter's overall shape, something that can unify all 150 psalms in the Psalter. At the outset, something of the big picture is needed before more inductive work can begin. We need, in other words, a virtual map of the psalmist's world. Virtual because such a world is itself metaphorically constructed. Because metaphor, by its very nature, generates unpredictable chains of association and more novel modes of coherence than lexical analysis alone permits. And it stands to reason that in lieu of the Psalter's bewildering diversity, some sense of unifying coherence can be obtained from an analysis of the Psalter's metaphorical contours. Past efforts spent at uncovering the Psalter's literary seams, conducting statistical analysis of word distributions, dissecting and identifying generic components, and ideologically deconstructing individual psalms, lines of analysis that were unthinkable to the psalmists who produced them and to the ancient readers who recited them. They have all helped to illumine the world that shaped the Psalter, to be sure. Yet, try as they might, they cannot fully account for the unifying shape of this variegated corpus, the theo-literary world the psalms themselves convey. Bluntly put, statistical studies and the identification of literary themes and formal components do not, at the end of the day, foster reverence and righteousness, the rhetorical aim of the psalmists. But perhaps a metaphorical analysis can. You see, the psalmists were poets, liturgists, lyricists, and yes, Dietrich, musicians. Their psalms are not simply ideological constructs or statistical word fields. Rather, together the psalms present the rich mosaic of faith. What then can be said about the overall shape of the Psalter, metaphorically? Shedding new light on this issue is the recent study of Jerome Creech, entitled Yahweh as Refuge. A student of James Mays at Union, whose work on the Psalms is well known, Creech has identified and expounded an important root metaphor in the Psalter that can serve as a point of departure for our investigation tonight. As the title to his revised dissertation reveals, the dominant metaphor of the Psalter that Creech identifies is refuge, machse in Hebrew. The bulk of his research is devoted to charting the distribution of this word field, which includes related words and images found throughout the Psalter, such as secure height, retreat, stronghold, fortress, place of protection, hiding place, shadow, rock, crag, not to mention a host of verbal forms. The pervasiveness of this word field, this refuge word field, indicates an editorial interest in the arrangement of individual psalms and sections of psalms that spans the entire Psalter, according to Creech. Now, the first canonical clue we encounter is actually a beatitude that was appended to Psalm 2, the second psalm, as an organizational heading for Psalms 3 to 41. Happy are all who take refuge in the Lord, verse 11. Creech has taken the signification of the refuge metaphor in the Psalter to a new level, one that rises above mere lexical attestation and ultimately rests on the conceptual. Refuge, Jerome Creech claims, is a common and recurring idea. But that, too, is really not sufficient. The literary scope of refuge must be examined as a root metaphor. Only as a metaphor can refuge form an expansive network of associations and forge a pervasive presence within its literary and liturgical environment to the extent that Creech wants to claim. Refuge, according to Creech, is a, quote, filter. A filter through which the Psalter in its entirety can be viewed theologically. Now, the litmus test, of course, is whether refuge as metaphor can cover the gamut of the Psalter's diversity. And what a diversity it is. To be sure, refuge is a motif that is as widespread throughout the Psalter as it is theologically suggestive. It signifies protection as well as moral resolve, relief from persecution as well as vindication and communion with God. One finds it operative even in the famous Shepherd Psalm that was sung and read tonight, which for all of its pastoral imagery, for all of its bucolic imagery, charts the harrowing journey of a refugee searching out sanctuary within the house of the Lord. How differently is the psalm used today, whether at funerals or for the sick? But that simply proves the case that through metaphor, a psalm can cover a gamut of applications. But really, refuge is not the only theme or motif in the Psalms. Though saturated with the themes of refuge, many of the psalmic prayers that we read in the Psalter are not uttered in the mystical half-light of a Gothic cathedral, or in the well-ordered psalmody of monastic oases, or in the silent chambers of the soul, to quote from Eric Singer. Now, there is at least one other motif that needs to be accounted for, an additional motif that one encounters almost as pervasive as refuge throughout the Psalter, and that's the metaphor of pathway. Both refuge and pathway have their distinctive usage and complementary associations. A path, by definition, is something on which one walks. Refuge, on the other hand, is a domain into which one enters. Pathway connotes faithful conduct and wisdom. It is something to be taught. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path. Psalm 27. Teach me the way I should go, for to you I lift up my soul. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Let your good spirit lead me on a level path. Psalm 143. You show me the path of life. Psalm 16. I will study the way that is blameless. When shall I attain it? Asks the psalmist of Psalm 101. And one can also add to the list also Psalm 23 with reference to the right paths or the paths of righteousness on which the speaker is led through the darkest valley into the sanctuary where there is a banquet arranged before him and his enemies. Now, there's always been a problem with the translation of Psalm 23, particularly in verse 6, and I still have not found an English translation that matches the Hebrew. I believe George read from the NRSV, but I'm still looking for the right translation of verse 6. It reads, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life." Well, that's a very lame translation. It should actually be translated, "Surely goodness and mercy shall pursue me all the days of my life." To pursue. You see, the psalmist pictures him or herself being pursued by enemies through the darkest valley. And then finally within safe haven and the sanctuary, he or she realizes that not enemies, but goodness and mercy are in pursuit, in dogged pursuit, nipping at his or her heels. Those are the gifts of God, and from which there is no escape. Goodness and mercy shall pursue me all the days of my life. Well, refuge, by contrast, is neither revealed nor taught, like pathway is. Refuge is not something one walks or is led upon, it is rather the domain of security established by and ultimately identified with God. So, within the psalmist's arsenal of metaphors, refuge is no more a central motif in the Psalter than path is a peripheral one, and vice versa. Together, pathway and refuge cover much of the psalmist's theological concerns and yearnings, from the sapiential to the liturgical. Moreover, we find an important connection between pathway and refuge, a conjunction characteristic no less of the Psalter's deep structure. Together, pathway and refuge capture both the journey and the destination the psalmists construct of their world. In the Psalter, the didactic dimension connoted by pathway is contextualized within the sacred parameters of refuge, holy sacred space. At the same time, refuge via pathway constitutes the goal and telos of learning and moral conduct. Together, pathway and refuge evoke a powerful setting for the praxis of faithful living, for worship and obedience. As Psalm 1, which we're going to look at a moment, as Psalm 1 lays out the path of righteousness, the journey is not complete without entrance into refuge, the world-embracing protective setting of thanksgiving, a veritable cosmos of praise limned in the final Psalms of 146 through 150, a veritable rite of passage or more precisely, a rite of incorporation is created by the user and prayer of psalms, incorporated into the communitas of God's favor, identified with the congregation of the righteous and the assembly of the faithful, according to the psalms. Out of the depths, from the mire of the pit to the rock and refuge of God, the psalmist traverses the path of deliverance and edification. But refuge is not only a destination, just as pathway marks not only a liminal state of transition. On the one hand, the prayer of the psalms, who in prayer embarks on the path, is already enclosed within the protective walls of refuge. On the other hand, the pathway, the psalmist's journey, is not finished once refuge is taken. Both pathway and refuge are constantly at work in the psalmist's rhetoric, operating simultaneously, at once ongoing and realized. Prayed and sung, the psalms perform and thereby construe a world of justice that is rife with holiness. Given its prominence in the Psalter, prayer, the act of prayer itself, establishes both refuge and path. It is both world-making and conduct-forming. And praying the Psalms prepares place by creating pathway, as it also blazes a path by establishing place. The Psalms, in short, limn a sanctuary movement. The psalmist's journey to God and God's coming to the people. The metaphors of pathway and refuge are the tectonic forces that give unifying shape to the Psalter's variegated landscape, and perhaps to our lives as well. Are we not as well going on a journey? Not a pilgrimage of glee, but a journey full of painful wrenchings and surprising gifts. The journey of faith, a journey that is not without its destination, a destination that we are to call home, to live in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. And yet, it is a home, the house of the Lord, that is occupied by the community which continues on the pathway. How is a path formed? Not by any individual, but by the passage of many feet, the community. And so you can see how these two metaphors, pathway and refuge, are powerful enough to shape the very contours of the Psalter and our lives. Well, so much for a brief look at the big picture of the Psalter. And again, there is a bewildering diversity within the Psalter itself. But now is the time for us to sort of roll up our sleeves and take a look at a particular psalm. And I propose that psalm to be the first psalm, Psalm 1. And I entitle this part of the lecture, The Transplanted Tree, or Everything You Wanted to Know About Botany in the Bible, but Were Afraid to Ask. Could somebody please turn on the overhead? Okay, thank you. The first psalm has been typically considered the hermeneutical entry point into the Psalter, and for good reason. This psalm lacks a superscription or title, contains a number of lexical links to the following psalms, and underscores particular themes and images found throughout the Psalter. Together with the following psalm, Psalm 2, this psalm serves to introduce the Psalter, and by introducing it, guides the reader's use of subsequent psalms. Standing, hence, at the very threshold of the Psalter, Psalm 1 directs the reader's ear to the myriad of voices that emerge from the belly of the Psalter. From the cry of despair to the shout of jubilation, Psalm 1 identifies these voices all with the righteous. Let me read it. Happy is the one who neither walks in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but rather finds delight in the Torah of Yahweh and meditates on Yahweh's Torah day and night. He or she is like a tree, transplanted by channels of water, yielding its fruit in due season, and whose leaves do not wither. Everything that he or she does will find success. Not so with the wicked. They are rather like chaff the wind drives away. No wonder they will not endure the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For Yahweh knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. If you haven't guessed it, Psalm 1 is rich in metaphor. Even the pacing of the psalm is suggestive. The psalmist lovingly lingers over the profile of the righteous individual who remains in a state of continual study and blessed constancy, firmly rooted in Torah, or the law. Ah, wonderful image for all students of theology. Antithetically related, the wicked are hastily described. They are nothing more than wind-driven chaff, and the image needs no elaboration. The wicked require little attention, for they are tantamount to nothing. Not so with the righteous. They flourish, as it were, under the poet's lavished attention. In the psalmist's gentle hands, righteousness is shown to be a matter of growth, of gradual cultivation, much in contrast to the flickering movements and rootless existence that characterize the wicked, bereft of direction and gone with the wind. As Torah, or the law, provides the conceptual framework for this psalm, and thereby for the Psalter as a whole, so the tree, the image of the tree, constitutes the psalm's most evocative metaphor. And the following reflections I plan to make are in part inspired by the wonderful performance certain members of the CMU Singers had during the children's time at the Bethel Mennonite Church last Sunday. You know who you are if you're in the crowd. It was sort of a narrated pantomime about a tree that grows from a sapling to mature height. Much like what we find in the first psalm. Commanding the lion's share attention, this arboreal image has central standing in the psalm. In contradistinction to the image of the path, which brackets the psalm and conveys a sense of movement, is the image, the verdant image, of the fruit-bearing tree whose roots run deep beside channels of flowing streams. Associated with the wicked, the image of chaff that follows serves as an apt antitype to this central metaphor. That the image of the tree immediately follows the psalmist's reference to Torah's fundamental and sustaining role establishes a solid, albeit subtle, connection. By no means are Torah and tree haphazardly juxtaposed, brought together without rhyme or reason. As the righteous individual reaps joy and continual guidance from Torah, so the tree gains its sustenance from the ever-flowing channels of water beside which it is planted. Now, grammatically, the prepositions in and on in verse 2, it's the same word in Hebrew, which denote the individual's relationship to Torah. Do you see it? Let's see if this works. Verse 2. In the Torah of the Lord and on Yahweh's Torah. Those two prepositions find their counterpart in the preposition by in verse 3. There it is. By channels of water. They parallel each other in a way. as if to say that the edification that Torah provides is matched by the image of the well-nourished tree. The tree's proximity to and dependence upon the water channels is parallel to the individual's dependence upon Torah. Image and word together connote prosperity and success in all matters of conduct. Verse 3. Deeply rooted, the tree endures while the chaff is driven away before the gathering storm of judgment. Now, the power and range of this arboreal metaphor cannot fully be grasped without examining something of its mythic background in antiquity, as found elsewhere in ancient Near Eastern literature and iconography. Since the tree in Psalm 1 is more than simply a word or a concept, since it constitutes a riveting image, especially a metaphor, iconographic parallels are not surprising. Even on the textual surface, it is clear that the tree of Psalm 1 connotes the blessed life of the righteous individual. Its roots, however, can be discerned in the plethora of images found on material remains as early as the Middle Bronze Age, centuries before Israel ever was on the scene. One finds numerous seal impressions and tomb reliefs, as well as statues, images of goats or caprids eating the leaves and buds of trees. And let's have our first slide. We need to turn off the overhead and turn on the projector. There we go. Here we have the so-called golden goat found in a Sumerian grave at Ur. Notice the plant. It is as ornately made as the goat itself. Now, among seal impressions and later iconography from Quintilat Ajrud, the figure of the tree is located squarely in the center and profiled as a source of sustenance for these animals. So let's take a look at the next slide. You see on the top these seal impressions in which you have the tree in the middle bracketed by goats or caprids. And then the next slide, please. From Apithos and Kutilat Ajrud, there in the middle. There, too, you have a very ornately drawn plant with what looks like gazelles or caprids feasting upon it. Most striking are Akkadian seals from Syria that depict stalks and leafy branches sprouting from a goddess figure emerging from the earth. There at the very bottom, figure 4, you see this goddess figure emerging out of the earth, and she is sprouting. Frequently, as you can tell from this particular iconographic sample, the tree is associated with a goddess. Iconographist Othmar Kale has recently traced the development of the motif of tree and goddess from the Middle Bronze to the Iron Age, and observes that the goddess was venerated as a creator of vegetation, if not of life itself. Within this period, the tree and the goddess were frequently portrayed interchangeably. And in some instances, we've discovered seals and sculptures of genitalia of the goddess associated with the figure of a tree. And I'll spare you that slide. In the Iron Age, more variation on the theme is discernible. Terracotta shrine models from the 11th and 10th centuries, whose entrances are flanked by naked goddesses, seemingly correspond to entrances depicted in similar models of the 9th century that are flanked by stylized palm trees. Okay. Yeah, these are shrine models. They probably housed the figure of some deity. And you can see that the top two feature naked goddesses of the 11th century, the bottom two or 9th century models of about the same size, but they've changed. They're now like tree stocks that are used to demarcate the sacred space. No doubt this motif lies in the background of the so-called Jachin and Boaz pillars that flanked the vestibule of Solomon's temple. Next slide. There. Do you see the two pillars flanking the entrance to the temple? They resemble tree trunks. Two massive freestanding bronze columns adorned with pomegranate designs and capitals and decorated with carvings of palm trees and flowers as described in 1 Kings 7:21 and elsewhere. Next slide. There's another reconstruction of the facade of the Solomonic Temple. Although the precise significance of their names, Jachin and Boaz, as they are named in the Bible, although their significance is not known, the former could be read as "he establishes." They did seem to serve to demarcate sacred space by conveying a paradise setting of divine presence, the source of the temple's holiness, much like the terracotta shrine models discovered in Syria-Palestine between the 11th and 9th centuries BC, as we saw. Okay, this is another garden paradise scene vividly depicted on the wall paintings of an early 18th century palace at Mari, located on the banks of the Euphrates in modern Syria. In a courtyard that once led into a vestibule in front of the king's throne room, a mural scene features what appears to be a royal ceremony. Set within a luxuriant orchard and populated with fantastic creatures, the setting is easily discernible. It is a paradise garden, populated with date palms and stylized with papyrus stalks. And guarding the garden are winged sphinxes or cherubim, griffins, and bulls. Flanking the royal scene that depicts the king, presumably Zimri Lim, standing before the goddess Ishtar, are stylized trees and date palms whose fruits are harvested by human figures. It has been theorized that the actual courtyard of this temple in Mari enclosed live trees, in the middle of which was an artificial tree, standing with a wooden core and plated with bronze and silver leaf. The Mari mural, as you see, with its paradise garden scene, finds a parallel in Solomon's temple. The doors and interior walls of the Solomonic Temple, as we are told in the Bible, were similarly adorned with gilded carved wood reliefs of cherubim, ornamental palms, and calyxes, or open flowers. Ezekiel describes the temple walls as decorated with a pattern of cherubim and palm trees, with a palm tree between every two cherubim, Ezekiel 41, verse 18. Also worth mentioning is the well-known 10th century cult stand from Tanakh. There it is, made of terracotta and approximately 60 centimeters in height. The stand has four friezes or registers, two of which bear some association with the tree and goddess. The bottom register depicts a nude female standing between two lions, in correspondence perhaps to Asherah, known as the Lion Lady in West Semitic epigraphy, and whose children are known as her Pride of Lions in the royal archives at Ugarit. The second register from the top depicts a stylized tree flanked by capreids and also guarded by lions. Next slide. Here we have a close-up of those two registers. So you see Asherah and the two lions on the bottom, and you see this plant motif, this tree, flanked by capreids, as we've seen in the seal impressions earlier. Thus, two major related symbols are attested on a cult object that is, in the words of Susan Ackerman, permeated with the imagery of Asherah, namely the lion and the sacred tree. Yet the tree may signify nothing more than sacred space, the presence of a divine power, of prosperity and blessing, which ultimately resides in the earth. In any case, as in earlier iconography, the tree is personified to represent, according to Cale, a goddess of earth, of plant life, of sexuality and prosperity, whose most important achievement is the tree. Now, the use of gardens, and in particular trees, in association with religious centers, also has distinctly royal roots. It was common practice among ancient Near Eastern despots, from Egypt to Mesopotamia, to cultivate their palace and temple gardens with plants taken from conquered lands. Next slide. Yes. Assurbanipal II describes in methodical detail his palace garden, which marked the restoration of the new capital city, Kala, in his, quote, garden of happiness. Flourished, the despot claims, over 40 varieties of trees collected and transplanted from recently conquered territories. In their annals, Assyrian kings boasted that the trees and plants of the royal orchards thrived better under their green thumb, that is, in their transplanted condition, than in their natural habitats. What a boast! A particular telling scene can be found in a relief of Ashurbanipal's palace in Nineveh. Next slide. This portrays a lavishly landscaped garden, complete with lawn furniture and attentive servants. But there's something wrong with this picture. And who can find it out? This reminds me of those sheets that used to exercise young children's visual abilities, trying to identify what was wrong with this picture. You know, a shadow misplaced or something like that. But there's something actually quite wrong with this picture. Anything sort of strike you? Well, let me point to it. Can you see what that is? Within this luxuriant grove hangs the head of a defeated Elamite king as it dangles from the top of one of the trees. You see, the king's garden was literally a victory garden. Again, many of these trees were transplanted from conquered lands. And of course, to conquer, you have to, well, according to the Assyrian kings, to defeat the enemy. And so not only were trees brought back, but also the heads of the foreign rulers, and sometimes planted, if you will, in the garden. Now, as for Israel, the king of Judah was also known for his green thumb in the city of David. In the guise of Solomon, Kohelet of Ecclesiastes proclaims his royal prowess in his catalog of accomplishments in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. The historical books of the Bible also give mention of quote, the king's garden, unquote, which served as an escape route for Zedekiah when the city walls were breached by the Babylonian army, as in 2 Kings 25, verse 4. The garden included the pool of Shiloh, or king's pool, Shiloah, which was watered from the Gihon spring up the Kidron Valley. As archaeologist Lawrence Steger notes, the whole Kidron Valley at one time, most likely from the time of Solomon up to the end of the Davidic dynasty, consisted of a cascade of terraced gardens and parks, otherwise known as the Fields of Kidron. Next slide. There we go. The agricultural terraces of Kidron. You see the Kidron Valley. down there in the foreground, and particularly off to the left, you see it well watered by the spring of the Gihon. Of course, this is an artist reconstruction. We don't know exactly how it looked. Now, in the Pentateuchal literature, as well as in Joshua, particular trees and groves were considered evocative of divine presence. Specifically, such arboreal settings were thought to mark occasions for theophany. In Genesis, for example, we find Abraham building an altar to the Lord near Hebron at, quote, the oaks of Mamre, Genesis 13, verse 18. And these oaks of Mamre provide the setting for Abraham's encounter with the divine in the form of three mysterious visitors in Genesis 18. Now, the name of this oak, the oak of Moreh, literally means teacher, or perhaps oracle giver. It is also referred to as the diviner's oak in Judges 9:37. And finally, as Gordon Matthies knows quite well, in the ratification of the covenant at Shechem, Joshua, quote, wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak in the sanctuary of the Lord. Joshua 24, verses 26 to 27. Now, it must also be said that within Israel's worship, not every tree or grove had good standing in the sanctuary of the Lord. Isaiah, the prophet, evidently held a particular disdain for sacred groves. As we read in chapter 1, Zion shall be redeemed by justice, and those in her who repent by righteousness. For you shall be ashamed of the oaks in which you delighted, and you shall blush for the gardens that you have chosen. For you shall be like an oak whose leaf withers, and like a garden without water. The strong shall become like tinder, and their work like a spark. They and their work shall burn together with no one to quench them. Sort of as the prophetic antitype of Psalm 1. As a source of shame rather than delight, the trees of Zion are portrayed by the prophet as utterly desiccated and destined for burning, and so also the people. In other words, the prophet metaphorically suggests that you are what you plant. Instead of assuring success in all matters of work and conduct, misplaced ultimate concern will invariably result in total lack of fulfillment, even outright destruction. The strong and their work shall burn together. Might cannot hold a candle to righteousness, according to the prophet. Now, why oak trees are singled out, in particular by the prophet Isaiah, may reflect the fact that the Hebrew term for oak, an impressive tree in its own right, is related to the feminine form of a word that denotes divinity. In other words, oak can also mean goddess. In any case, the prophet condemns such sacred groves as pagan cult symbols. Similar condemnation is also found in chapter 17 of Isaiah. For you have forgotten the God of your salvation, and have not remembered the rock of your refuge. Therefore, though you plant pleasant plants, and set out slips of an alien god, though you make them grow on the day that you plant them, and make them blossom in the morning that you sow, yet the harvest will flee away in a day of grief and incurable pain. Although prized for their beauty and fruitfulness, the result of careful cultivation, the pleasant plants will only disappoint, according to the prophet. The cause of their demise is clear. The plants are redolent of apostasy. The cultivation and use of groves for cultic practice, specifically as settings for sacrifice, evidently continued well into the Persian period, despite Isaiah and his literary successor's protestations, as we read in Isaiah 65, verse 3. Well, as viewed by Isaiah and the Deuteronomists, the popularity of sacred trees and groves posed a clear challenge to centralized worship. Deuteronomy mandates the destruction of all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree. Deuteronomy 12:2. The danger of apostasy is painfully clear in a particular prohibition against cultic impurity found in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 21, which we read, "You shall not plant any tree as an Asherah beside the altar that you make for the Lord your God." Now, translated as sacred pole in the NRSV, the Asherah was a stylized tree, most likely related to the iconographic evidence found in Palestine and elsewhere, as we've seen. The biblical description is also suggestive. The cult object is made or built, stood up, planted, or erected. And when destroyed, it is burned, cut down, hewn down, uprooted, overturned, or broken. Some association with the goddess Asherah is evident, though to what extent remains debatable. There's an image of the goddess Asherah of Ugaritic fame. As the consort of the high god and progenitor deity El, featured in Ugaritic mythology, Asherah was regarded as the fertility goddess par excellence, the mother of the gods. Although such mythopoeic literature nowhere connects Asherah specifically with a tree, as what we might find in some of the seal impressions that we've looked at earlier, the tree, as I've noted, most certainly symbolizes fertility and vegetation, which the goddess represents. Now, was Asherah worshipped in Israel? Well, I'm glad you asked that question. There are, in fact, two archaeological sites within Israel, Kuntilat Ashrud and Hirbet Elkom, in which we find in certain written prayers for blessing the phrase Yahweh and his Asherah. Such evidence, though ambiguous, suggests at the very least that the Asherah object, the tree, was associated with Yahweh worship in popular form. Whether simply a cult object or a full-fledged deity or consort to the Lord, the stylized tree and its symbolic power were deemed anathema by Yahwistic orthodoxy. And you can see why. It should also be noted that the Deuteronomists did in fact associate Asherah with an actual goddess, perhaps in the sense of a divine consort. The Deuteronomists thus polemically interpreted, whether correctly or incorrectly, the stylized tree as representative of the goddess herself, hence warranting nothing less than outright condemnation of its presence and use within worship. The Deuteronomist interpretation, notwithstanding its polemically inspired basis, was not without warrant. In fact, the noted iconographist Christoph Eulinger has recently proposed that a terracotta object discovered in the late Iron Age sanctuary of Sarepta and published by Jörg Jeremias actually features Yahweh and his Asherah sitting together on a throne. Next slide. Do they not make a cute couple? Well, that's in part conjecture. I mean, nowhere do we have a sign that says Yahweh and his Asherah. But Christoph Eulinger proposes that this may actually represent just that. Okay, can we have the lights back on now? That's the end of our slide program. All in all, this is all to show that trees in the sanctuary or in the proximity thereof held a rather ambivalent place with an ancient Israelite faith and worship. Their standing depended, of course, on the precise signification such trees bore within true Israelite worship. If the tree symbol connoted Yahweh's creative power to bless, recalling the shalom of the primordial Garden of Eden, then its legitimacy was secure. Rejection was warranted, however, if the image of the tree was at all suggestive of another deity, consort or otherwise. In short, a tree flourishing in the precincts of the Lord was a matter of grave contention. So with all the bad press trees get from Orthodox legislation as found in the Bible, in Deuteronomy or in the classical prophets such as Isaiah, it seems to me rather daring that the opening psalm of the Psalter develops arboreal imagery at all. The poet's specific commendation of Torah, moreover, suggests some awareness of Deuteronomic legislation against the use of trees in Israel's cultic life. That, coupled with the widespread prophetic critique, makes it highly unlikely that the poet behind Psalm 1 was naive enough as to tread blindly on theologically suspect ground. The boldness of the poet's use of the tree image in Psalm 1 is all the more apparent in light of the tree's envisioned landscape. The tree image in Psalm 1 has its home specifically within the temple setting. And this is confirmed by special reference to the channels of water given in verse 3. Channels of water. Human-made channels of water, not natural springs are referred to here. And this suggests some relationship to Zion, the sanctuary of God. One can think of several psalms that refer to channels of water, one of which might be Psalm 46. There is a river whose channels make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. Here, as well as in Psalms 36 and 65, river and stream are inextricably linked to Zion, the mountain of God, suggesting that the reference to channels of water in Psalm 1 reflects also a distinctly sanctuary setting. But in none of these passages is specific mention made of trees. Not so with our psalm. In light of the strident critique issued by the prophets and the Deuteronomists, a baum within the bulwark of God is striking. Again, given the lateness of the text of Psalm 1 and its central reference to Torah, some familiarity on the part of the poet with the negative assessment of the use of trees in proximity to the sanctuary is reasonable to assume. If indeed this is the case, then Psalm 1 highlights an ingenious solution to this intractable matter of contention. By turning the arboreal image into a metaphor, the psalmist has delimited certain possibilities of association while generating other lines of association. You see, the tree in Psalm 1 is not an Asherah pole, or any stylized tree for that matter. It connotes rather the righteous individual who begins to enter into the psalmist's world of worship and study, a literary sanctuary or refuge. The didactic poet has turned a controversial cultic object into an evocative metaphor. The poet has turned an image of apostasy into an icon of righteousness. The tree has taken on the identity of the worshiper, the character of one whose delight is in Torah, the reader of Psalms. Rather than indicating goddess, earth, or even the power of fertility, the tree featured at the threshold of the Psalter is reflexive of the reader who desires to grow in righteousness and thereby bask in God's blessing. Not only is the tree permitted within the sphere of the holy, its presence is mandated. The poet has drawn deep from the well of mythopoeic tradition by choosing this central, evocative metaphor, the figure of the tree, with its range of powerful associations, in order to orient forcefully the reader of Psalms. The psalmist has, in effect, placed a tree at the entrance to the Psalter, at the threshold of its refuge, and at the head of its pathway. Perhaps most significantly, the Psalter's opening chapter, Psalm 1, with its profile of the tree, serves to shape the Psalter as a book of devotion and worship. You see, like the freestanding pillars that flank the entrance to the temple, demarcating it as sacred space from the world of the common and profane, so the opening psalm delineates the Psalter as wholly instructive and comprehensively liturgical in its scope. Moreover, like Solomon's temple, adorned with elaborate carvings of flora and some fauna on its walls and doors, the tree standing at the entrance of the Psalter is a powerful metaphor that sets in relief the myriad of botanical figures featured within the Psalter. The tree, in short, is a riveting image meant to accompany the reading of the Psalter, for it connotes the reader in his or her own growth and maturity. Now, most akin to the first psalm and its central metaphor are two evocative references to trees flourishing in the temple found elsewhere in the Psalms. As chaff is separated from the edible grain on the threshing floor, so on Zion, the former threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite, stand the righteous as flourishing trees, as we read in Psalm 92. The righteous one flourishes like the palm tree and grows like a cedar in Lebanon. They are transplanted in the house of the Lord. They flourish in the courts of our God. In old age, they still produce fruit. They are always green and full of sap, showing that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Psalm 92, verses 12 to 15. As the most fertile place on earth, Zion is where the righteous flourish, according to the psalmist. The date palm symbolizes the vitality that exceeds even old age, much in contrast to the withering grass and mortality conveyed in Psalms 90 and 103. But woven into such a testimony to physical potency, sustained and nurtured in the garden temple, is a distinctly moral fiber. Like Torah in Psalm 1, Zion in Psalm 92 constitutes the ethos, or setting, as it were, for the cultivation of righteousness. Zion points to the rock of righteousness, one of the many metaphors for divine strength and refuge. God has delivered the psalmist from mortal danger, vindicating him or her in the presence of evil assailants, verses 10 through 11. The source of righteousness, however, comes not from the psalmist's initiative, but from the Lord's deliverance and beneficence. The psalmist's flourishing in the fertile field of the Lord is a sign of grace, of God's salvific righteousness, not of human merit. Psalm 52 conveys similar image to underscore divine vindication of the one who has sought refuge in God. In verses 8 and 9 we read, "But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the steadfast love of God forever and ever. I thank you forever because of what you have done. In the presence of the faithful I will proclaim your name, for it is good." Again, righteousness is construed not as a moral initiative on the part of the psalmist, but as a matter of divine grace, and specifically in this psalm, of trust in God's enduring covenantal favor. So in both these psalms, Psalms 92 and 52, along with their closest analog, Psalm 1, make explicit what is already implicit in the opening psalm, namely that righteous as trees have their home in Zion. As the king is set upon Zion, God's holy hill, in order to bring about victory and dominion over those foreign nations that conspire against the Lord and his anointed, Psalm 2, so the righteous are firmly planted within the temple, which serves as both a refuge and, if you will, a botanical conservatory, metaphorically a hothouse for moral growth. Finally, crucial to the very message of Psalm 1 and of the Psalter as a whole is a term shared in common by verse 3 of Psalm 1 and verse 14 of Psalm 92, transplant. The tree is not simply planted, but transplanted. That is, transported from a non-specified location into a well-specified surrounding, rooted in Torah and located in proximity to the temple, in order for it to thrive unhindered. As the ancient Near Eastern kings boasted of their horticultural prowess in transplanting exotic plants from their newly conquered territories, so the psalmist speaks of God, the divine gardener, delivering and cultivating the righteous. The historical analog to the language of horticulture is found specifically in Psalms 44 and 80, which also use horticultural metaphors. We have heard with our ears, O God, our ancestors have told us, what deeds you performed in their days and the days of old. You with your own hand drove out the nations, but them you planted. You afflicted the peoples, but them you set free. Psalm 44. Or Psalm 80. You brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shade, the mighty cedars with its branches. It sent out its branches to the sea and its shoots to the river. Psalm 80, verses 8-11. The historical casting of Israel's cultivation elicits a new understanding of the Psalter's opening psalm, as well as its offshoots, Psalms 52 and 92. The righteous individual transplanted on the soil of Zion is paralleled with Israel's historical passage from bondage to deliverance and ultimately its constitution in the land. Typical of the lament psalms, wrenching descriptions of personal affliction, persecution, and physical debilitation graphically convey realities from which the psalmist pleads to God for relief. And such conditions, too, are brought into correspondence with bondage and demoralization, individualized and personalized. In most cases, the psalmist petitions for a way to safety and restoration, culminating in a peal of praise, frequently cast within the sanctuary itself. And by employing the technical term of transplanting, the poet of Psalm 1 echoes Israel's own pilgrimage of release and fulfillment, applying it to the plight of the individual, now restored and sustained by channels of flowing streams. In so doing, the opening psalm adumbrates the end and culmination of the Psalter itself, praise given by a restored member of the community, vindicated and vouchsafed by God. The opening psalm initiates then a dramatic movement that helps to give overall shape to the Psalter as a whole. The tree is planted, transplanted, beside waters that issue forth from the sanctuary. In Psalms 52 and 92, the tree has gained full entrance into the precincts of the Lord, flourishing within the temple itself. Moreover, the righteous have aged reaching full maturity, yet still full of sap and bearing fruit. Psalm 92, verse 14. Near the end of the Psalter, nestled amid peals of praise that issue forth from the courts of God, botanical imagery has spread its shoots, as it were, to envelop the whole family and the nation of Israel, as we find in Psalms 128 and 144. While the wicked wither away like, quote, grass on the housetops, Psalm 129. The psalmist's enemies, indeed, all those who impede the supplicant from treading the path of life toward God's refuge, have either vanished or they have been redeemed within the ever-expanding world of praise envisioned by the psalmists. The growth of botanical imagery in the Psalter reflects the general movement of the Psalms toward unobstructed reverence to God, both within and beyond the inviolable walls of God's refuge. Psalm 1 profiles, in effect, the beginning reader of Psalms as a seedling, as a sapling whose stalk may bend but not break before the wind that drives away the chaff. With continued sustenance from both stream and soil, from the life-giving, sustaining power of Torah, the sapling can grow to unprecedented heights of moral maturity. As an icon of apostasy, rather as an icon not of apostasy, but of righteousness, the tree of Psalms 1, 52, and 92 has its way, its journey, held in God's palm, carried from danger and desiccation to the fertile land of peace and flowing streams. The tree is planted in shalom, in the blessing of Zion, and in the sustenance of Torah, cultivated to cover the mountains under its protective shade as the waters cover the sea. Let the reader understand and choose the path of life that leads to the garden of delight the psalmist beckons. And speaking of gardens, the fiction writer and essayist E.B. White tells of his wife Catherine plotting her garden in October. Armed with a diagram and a clipboard, Catherine would get into a shabby old Brooks raincoat, much too long for her, put on a little round wool hat, pull on a pair of overshoes, and proceed to the director's chair, a folding canvas thing that had been placed for her at the edge of the garden plot. And there she would sit, hour after hour, in the wind and the weather, while Henry Allen produced dozens of brown paper packages of new bulbs in a basket full of old ones, ready for the intricate interment. As the years went by and age overtook her, there was something comical, yet touching, in her bedraggled appearance on this awesome occasion. The small, hunched-over figure, her studied absorption in the implausible notion that there would yet be another spring, oblivious to the ending of her own days, which she knew perfectly well was near at hand, sitting there with her detailed chart under those dark skies in the dying October, calmly plotting the resurrection. My friends, in Christ, the resurrection has been plotted. The garden is growing, nourished by the vibrant colors of the streams of living water. Imagine that.